This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Quite suddenly, transgenderism has gone from being a deviant fringe behavior to being something you can actually be punished by law for not supporting. There's a particularly strong movement in society to teach our children about transgenderism, to encourage gender fluidity in our children. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Dennis Leap about this trend, and he's going to tell us why this is actually a form of child abuse. If you have children, you're facing this issue, you definitely want to listen to this segment. The nation of Turkey is very important geopolitically, and it is at a crossroads. Its president is moving the country away from its secular history to become more Islamic, and he's reevaluating the nation's alliances. He's asserting a greater role in the region. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about why it's so important we watch this nation. He'll explain how history and biblical prophecy cut through the uncertainty to show us the direction that Turkey will take and the impact this will have on world events. A new poll shows a big increase in the number of Americans who consider themselves spiritual but not religious. What does that mean exactly, and why should we be concerned about it? We'll talk with Trumpet writer Kieran Underwood about this question. And finally, we'll talk about a terrific way to grow as a person by helping others to grow, fulfilling your duty as a mentor. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Transgenderism has exploded into the mainstream in the last few years. Laws are being passed making it illegal to call someone by the wrong pronoun. Other workplace protections are being put in place to show the public's acceptance of what was until very recently considered deviant behavior. Perhaps the arena where this battle is being waged most aggressively is with children. Public elementary schools are working to make themselves friendly for children who want to come to school dressed like the opposite sex. Clothing manufacturers are moving into producing sexless clothing for children. Parents are being pressured to avoid making suggestions to their children about their gender so the kids can freely choose. Trumpet writer Dennis Leap has written an article with the provocative title, Encouraging Gender Fluidity is Child Abuse. He's here to talk about this article with us. Hello.
Hello.
It's good to have you here. We appreciate you coming.
It's great to always be here at Trumpet Hour.
So talk about the pressures that parents are facing today to encourage gender fluidity in their children.
First of all, it was an amazing article to research and get ready. It is amazing how... I bring out the very beginning of the article. There's all these names that I never understood, like, you know, cisgendered and transsexual and pansexual and what all these things mean. But they've really entered into the legal system. And, of course, our public schools are tied to the legal system. And just our whole society is tied into it. And these words have become, like, really powerful in the sense that they're changing the way we view things. Of course, everyone can remember, you know, what happened in North Carolina with the, you know, with the bathroom situation and how that was made major, you know, news. But that was a legal issue. It's now entered into the world of children. It's amazing that there's just a situation that happened in England. Actually, it's on the Isle of Wight, so maybe we should say Great Britain. But where a young couple had their boy in an actually a religious school. And one of his friends showed up one day in a dress. And in other words, this child was considered transgendered and was going to, you know, think about being a girl. And the little boy came home all confused, and he said to his parents, "How can my friend, who was a boy, now be a girl?" And so what they did is they pulled their boy out of school, and then also they went and they said that you know, the school was actually abusing their child because now he was confused, and so there's a lawsuit and all that. But essentially what's happened is they were interviewed on a news report on the Isle of Wight. The news reporters said that they had the problem, they and their son had the problem, that these things should just be accepted and they had no right to be critical. They said, you have the problem, children can adapt. And there have been just a few voices, even in the medical field, that no, a two-year-old doesn't know whether they're transgender or not. Recently, a psychologist in California who helps run this rainbow camp for supposedly transgender children, and you can go to this camp as early as age four, she came out and said that children at two can know they're transgendered. But there's a whole legal system to support that, and even the medical field now is coming around and saying, yes, you know, children can be transgendered at two, and that the parents should begin affirming this. In other words, if a boy wants to wear dresses, then you start buying them dresses. And if a girl wants to just be a boy and buy her all cars, then you buy her cars. And it's really gone like to the kind of like the very foundation where you can begin working on this mind of a young child at, you know, at 2 years old.
Right. It makes sense that they would go after kids that don't know any better. And you're talking about two parallel trends and they're working together. One, just sort of societal acceptance and mainstream discussion about it. But as you said, when you bring in the legal aspect of it, then they have this weapon to essentially enforce this view on the rest of society, even if it's a small percentage of people that's doing this. Maybe you could give us some ideas of more of the legal ramifications that are taking place and how big the movement is becoming. Even if it's a small group that's starting, it is spreading rapidly, isn't it?
It is. I mean, there's a big movement in both Canada and the United States with the idea of use of pronouns. Right now, the situation is such that you have biological parents, you have a man and a wife. The wife is staying a female, but the husband is changing into a transgendered female. I mean, that's actually happening. And this is a situation in Canada. They have a son who they are calling they. They're not calling him he. They're not calling him she. And so when they go to school, the school has to call them they. And if the school calls him he or she, you can actually be caught in a lawsuit by using the, you know, the pronoun he or she.
It gets really complicated fast.
Yeah, but it's all a matter of this is the whole legal move for transgender rights. You cannot sound like you're critical or disagreeing with it. And essentially what's happened is that, you know, a lot of transgender and homosexual and lesbian proponents are lawyers, and they have gotten these legal systems changed so that you have to protect the rights of, you know, transgendered parents who want their children to have no identity. In other words, they want them to be able to choose themselves. But essentially that's a lie, because they're affirming to the child all the time what gender they are.
Right. If you have parents that are calling a child they rather than whatever the biological sex of the child is, that's going to introduce ideas into the child's mind that would never be there otherwise. Even the pretense is that this is actually meant to help the child by not forcing them one way or the other, that you're allowing the child to choose, when in actuality it's introducing confusion into the child's
exactly.
life.
Exactly. And that's what this family on the Isle of Wight, I feel bad for them, but their son was absolutely confused. It would be confusing to have your best friend. I'm not saying that's exactly the way it is, but if you imagine, I imagine when I was in kindergarten, I had best friends that were boys. I can't imagine what would have done to me if they came into school one morning and they were now, instead of being Bruce, they were Sally. I mean, that would throw me into confusion.
The thinking is that they're helping the children. You say that it's actually child abuse. Maybe you can just talk about, I mean, we kind of been setting this up a bit, but what is it that makes this child abuse?
Well, there is some medical complications with it, but also there are psychological complications with it. I mean, you can mess a child up psychologically as well as physically. But there is a pediatrician out there. She's actually the president of one of the largest pediatrician associations in America. And essentially, if you look at what they call it the transgender protocol, and this is established by the American Medical Association, it's established by the American Psychological Association, that if your son comes in one day and he says, well, I want to start wearing princess dresses, then according to this protocol, you have to start buying that child dresses. And then anytime he wants to wear a dress, he should be allowed to wear a dress. Same thing would be true if a girl wanted to play with trucks. You just buy trucks. So then you kind of listen to them and work with them. And if they have their, you know, their transgender pronouns mixed up, or their, you know, if they call themselves she, then you keep affirming that. Well, then when they get to be around 11 or 12, if they still insist on this, then you start getting the puberty blockers hormones going. Then at 16, a girl could have a mastectomy. Wow. And then at 18, then a boy can have, you know, what they call bottom surgeries. And that's, they could have their genitals actually removed and changed.
18 years old.
So that's 18 year old. So in other words, this one pediatrician who has a sense of sanity says that is physical abuse of children. Mm-hmm. To even put them on puberty blockers when she knows in the long run, when actually this was called a disorder, mm-hmm. that most kids, I think it's like up in the high 90% came out of it after going through puberty.
So in other words, you had kids that, it's not necessarily that unusual for a child to express curiosity or a bit of
not at all
confusion about that. But if you just let it play out, or if you say, look, you're confused, you know, and you set them straight, then it's not, they emerge from that without any harm done whatsoever.
Right. I bring out in the article, of course, we had four daughters. I have nine grandchildren. You know, four are boys, five are girls. None of them ever said to me or to my wife or to their parents, wow, I feel like I'm a girl trapped in a boy's body. And I've never had, you know, any of them say, I wish I was born a girl, I wish I was born a boy. And the thing is almost all of them got their pronouns confused. You know, it just right. That's going to happen when they start talking. I mean, kids start talking between 18 and 2, you know, and they might look at you and call you she because they were a girl. And no, that's a he. You know, it's just a matter of education.
Right.
And, you know, I've had grandsons that were playing when the granddaughters are doing dress up and dresses. And here's this little guy crawling on the floor. Of course, he's going to be curious. Mm-hmm. You teach him.
Right.
Well, this is what girls do. Here, why don't you come play with this toy? Or why don't you play with that? And that is now considered abnormal.
Right. To do that. You're actually not supposed to guide and direct your children, not supposed to educate them. You're supposed to try to discern these clues and these hints of confusion among the child,
right.
And then encourage those hints of confusion so that they flower into full-blown dysphoria.
Right, exactly. One psychologist even in California is recommending that if you want to know if your child is confused about their gender, you take them to a hotel, you dress in the opposite gender, and you see what their reaction is. Well, do you like this? You know, can you imagine me taking my grandsons to a hotel, me putting on a dress and then saying to them, well, so does this look good to you?
So this is what they're recommending.
This is what they're recommending parents do in order to figure out if their child is going through transgender confusion.
So, well, let's just talk about the real agenda here. What is behind this? I mean, it seems very clear that these folks are trying to magnify the public population of transgender, and they're using children basically as their experiment group.
That's exactly right. And the thing is there, what I found in doing the research for this, and this is by this Diane Ehrensaft, and she gets very honest in one of her books about this has been a plan. This has been a plan starting with feminism. The title of the book is My Son Wears Heels, and she gives the introduction to the book. And she says very clearly, she traces it back from the time she became a feminist. She said that the feminists and the LGBT communities joined together, and they worked very hard to get homosexual marriage approved. You know, they worked very hard to get all this done. And she says, now it's just mesmerizing that we now have these laws in this country that you can't do reparative therapy on children who think they're transgendered. So there's been a real movement to accomplish these things. And basically, they want to destroy biblical family, or they want to destroy traditional family. They want family can be anything people think it should be. You know, and so it really has been a real conspiracy, has really been a real plan. And she admits it. She's not afraid to publish it. I don't think we should be afraid to publish what she says either.
Yeah. I do think it's worth mentioning in this context that This transgenderism has been going on for as long as human beings have been around on the earth, which is the reason why in Deuteronomy 22 and verse 5, God actually says, he gives the command, the woman shall not wear that which pertains unto a man, neither shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all that do so are abomination unto the Eternal, your God. That's about as politically incorrect as you can get. But there's a reason why God put that in there, in order to try to help us to avoid the confusion that, happens when you start going down that road.
Exactly.
Maybe you could just finish with giving anyone who's interested in learning more about this subject maybe some resources that they could go to learn more.
Well, I do think there's, of course, Herbert Armstrong is our namesake. I think everyone that listens to Trumpet Hour knows that. But he wrote some interesting articles. Now, the articles aren't necessarily available. But he wrote an article one time, is a groundbreaking article, What Psychologists Don't Know About Child Rearing. And really, the issues with transgenderism or the issue with a child being confused about their identity, it's really a child rearing issue. It's not a matter that you go and get them surgically fixed. And even Critella brings out in her article, there is no biological basis for transgenderism. That is a big platform or plank in their platform. Is this? They say there's transgendered brains and all that. They have done the really good studies have proven all that false. But it really is. It's a matter of teaching law, teaching morality. I mean, it's like we have the Bible. It's very clear about homosexuality. It's an abomination. I mean, those are moral issues. These are things that you teach children. And the one thing that Herbert Armstrong brings out is that so many people don't understand even how men and women are created, but we're created with this human spirit that gives us the ability to think and to reason. And children have this. But when they're born, it's a blank slate. And what they need to be is taught. And so this whole thing with transgenderism in a child, it's really what an adult transfers onto a child. It's not the children. I mean, I've been around a lot of 18-month and 2-year-olds. They don't have any idea what sex they are. Mm-hmm. It's just crazy. But anyway, there is one of our books, I think, that explains this very clearly is The Incredible Human Potential by Herbert Armstrong. It talks about the human spirit. And it talks about the human mind. And to be honest, it also talks about that, the parents need to realize they have to teach their children. They have to teach this mind. And if they don't, well, Satan the devil does. And the point is if we're going to be really honest and we're going to be really truthful, the being that's behind all this transgenderism is Satan the devil getting into these minds of people, one, that just aren't normal. I mean, any psychologist that would recommend a family cross-dress and take your kid out to a hotel and cross-dress with them, why, where does that come from? Mm-hmm. That doesn't come from the mind of God, let's put it that way. I think also, the booklet that you wrote, The Redefining Family, would be a great booklet for people to get and just wake up to these things that there is this plan to destroy family and it's going to wreck society. Can you imagine if time would go on long enough and there's now 40 clinics in the United States that try and help parents with these little kids and they're transforming these kids. Can you imagine, in 10 years, would there be 80? Would there be 120? And can you imagine a society full of people that have had themselves changed? And what is society going to be like? It's bizarre.
Yeah.
And it's also very much like, Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, let's be honest about that.
Yeah, I think it's worse. I just wonder how much of that kind of confusion was going on.
Well, maybe not had the surgeries and things that they could do, or the puberty blockers. So, but it really is for any parent out there, and any grandparent. It's really, to me, it's very alarming and it's shocking, and it just shows that we're really in pretty bad straits in society.
Yeah, we've been talking with trumpet writer Dennis Leap. He has written an article for thetrumpet.com called "Encouraging Gender Fluidity Is Child Abuse." Watch for that. It should appear on the website very shortly. We appreciate you talking about it with us.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The nation of Turkey is a pivotal power in geopolitics. Geographically, this nation is at the crossroads of the world. It's a crucial part of the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance, NATO. It was key in the West's fight against communism. It really has played a crucial role in world events historically and even in recent decades. But now Turkey itself is at a crossroads. It's undergoing a massive transformation. This has been happening for decades under the leadership of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Turkey has been a secular power for decades, and Erdogan is bringing Islam back into Turkish politics. He's rejecting the West's democratic norms. He's drawing closer to Russia at the expense of Turkey's Western allies. So Turkey's role in the world and its allies, even its very identity, are in flux right now. Where is Turkey heading? This is an important question because Turkey's fate is important to the fate of the world. To talk about this, we have from our office in Britain, trumpet writer Richard Palmer. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
Well, I tried to set the table a bit to explain why it is so important that we watch what's going on in Turkey. Maybe you could just give your point of view at why it is just critical that we keep our eyes on what's happening in this pivotal nation.
Well, everything you said is great. And in some ways, the answer is it's almost impossible not to watch Turkey. I mean, at the moment, I see them in the news every single day. And this is the pivotal moment in Turkish history in so many ways right now. There's lots of people looking at them and saying, which way are they going to go? Are they going with Russia? Are they going with Iran? You've got this big idea of, are they falling out with Germany? What type of power are they going to be? Are they going to be an Islamist nation? This is the key point in Turkish modern history to really watch it. And as we watch that, of course, there's so many Bible prophecies that tie in with this. That in watching Turkey right now, you can already see some spectacular examples of the Bible providing relevance to news today, of where the Bible and this approach of watching Bible prophecy has already been proven right. And at the same time, when it comes to looking at, well, because we're just midway through this transformation, the Bible provides just a clear guide of where Turkey is next on this subject, or where Turkey is going next on this subject on which there is so much confusion.
Right. Yeah, excellent. So you have an article in the new print edition of The Trumpet. It's called Pivotal Power, talking about Turkey. I'd like you to, if you could, just establish the historical context for what's happening here. You talk about this in your article, and you're quoting Robert Kaplan in The Revenge of Geography, and just helping us to understand why it is that Turkey has played such an important role in so many crucial historical events and why that's relevant today.
Well, Turkey, if we take just a broad sweep of all of Turkish history, the Turks first came around during the 16th, 17th century. You had the Turkish Empire, and it very quickly kind of reached a peak and then settled into a long period of decay. But throughout all of that history, Turkey's played an important role as a bridge between Europe and the Middle East, between Europe and Islam. And now that we're seeing so much of world news events revolve around Europe and Islam, well, that puts the focus on Turkey once again. So you've got kind of that background going on. And at the same time, you've got what's going on just within Turkey itself. So you've got, after Turkey was in decay for a long time, but the real knockout blow that destroyed the Ottoman Empire was World War I. And after that, Turkey was at another of these major pivot points, and which there were a whole number of different directions that it was going to go, what was going to happen. And Kemal Atatürk founded Turkey then as a secular state. A lot of overt religious symbolism was outlawed. Politics was going to be secular because Atatürk looked at a very backward Middle East, and he looked at, and the future was in Europe, progressive Europe. And so he basically said, we're going to make Turkey a European nation. And Islam was going to play the same role in his vision of Turkey in Turkey that Christianity plays in modern Europe and contemporary Europe. It's there. It's the religion of a lot of people, but it's not run by the priests.
Right.
And so that's what he did for Turkey. And now under Recep Tayyip Erdogan, we've just seen more and more of him changing that, of reversing Ataturk's reforms, his way of government. And, you know, this is something we've written on at the Trumpet for decades. I think you had one of our main articles on that about 10 years ago or so. So that's not a new story, but every year you've seen an intensification in this direction. And he's just gone further and further to destroying what Ataturk set up. And I think now it's become clear that the Turkey and the system of rule that Ataturk set up in Turkey is gone. It's over. It's never coming back. And Turkey has been taken now in a different direction.
So, and at the same time that we see the Islamification of Turkey, we're also seeing Erdogan making considerable headway in strengthening Turkey's military. And if you look at Turkey's mm-hmm. military in the context of what's happening within the Middle East and these other Islam-dominated nations, it really stands head and shoulders above these other nations, doesn't it?
That's right. I just recently there have been announcements about Turkey buying an aircraft, or they've already got an aircraft carrier, announcements they want to build an aircraft carrier. And you kind of look at Turkey and you think, well, what do they want with an aircraft carrier? An aircraft carrier isn't a tool for defending the homeland. And historically, in the post-Cold War era, that's what the Turkish army has been all about, just defending Turkey from, say, a Soviet invasion. But the fact that they're now starting to get interested in things like aircraft carriers, and already they're one of the only Middle Eastern powers that has any kind of aircraft carrier, it shows that they're a power that's looking at projecting power abroad once again. And at you see this with their military bases. They have been using this crisis in Qatar that we've been talking about in a variety of other contexts. They've been using that to cement their relationship with Qatar, to back Qatar, to establish a military base in Qatar. They're establishing a military base in Somalia, in the Horn of Africa. So they're moving beyond this very large and very powerful but static military into a force that's much more mobile. And so that's why you've got people talking about the new Ottoman Empire. That's the subhead in one of my articles, but Geopolitical Futures in March, they wrote that studying the Ottomans' history is important because it shows where Turkey is going. Turkey is a very strong country and is becoming stronger. So it's spreading throughout the Middle East. And then things like the Syria crisis and the rise of Iran are forcing it just to continue spreading its power, projecting its power, maybe not in areas where there's oceans, but on into Syria, into Iraq, because if it knows that if it doesn't, Iran is just going to keep pushing into those areas.
Right. So you have this discussion within your article about this crossroads that Turkey finds itself in, this decision point. It seems to be pursuing a stronger alliance with Russia at the expense of its relationship with Germany. You just talk about the factors that would suggest that the long-term interests of Turkey would tend to drive it far more into the hands of Germany than it would Russia. Maybe you can just establish that point of argument for us.
That's an important, and it's something important to watch. I mean, when I mentioned at the beginning about seeing headlines, most of the headlines you see from Turkey about this escalating disagreement between Germany and Turkey.
Right.
But before I outline the background that you just mentioned, it's important to note that the Germans see it the same way. One of the German think tank that is responsible for advising the military produced a paper where they basically talked about how, you know, we can be tough with Turkey because in the long run, their alliance with Russia has no future. So this thinking is the same. That is the thinking of Germany as well. And that's part of the reason why they're not making much of an effort to cave in to Turkey or to give in to Turkey's demands, because they think they've got Turkey in the bag. But if you look at Turkey's relationship with Russia, historically, it's just about always been conflict. I think it's hard to even find a time where the two have ever really had close relationships with each other. It's almost comical where you look at the history of Russia and Turkish conflicts, and historians have kind of given up naming their various wars. It's just, this was the first Russia's Turkish war, this was the second, this was the seventh. You know, it just keeps, or just the years of the war, they've just constantly fought each other.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see why, because anytime Turkey wants to expand, well, where's it expanding? It's expanding into the Balkans, it's expanding into the Caucasus, it's expanding around the Black Sea, exactly the same areas that Russia traditionally always expands into. At the same time, Russia, you know, they want a warm water port. They want to be able to, you know, their ports, at least in the European kind of area of Russia that they have, freeze over in the winter. They want somewhere where they can have access to trade, have military access to warm water ports. The best place for that is the Black Sea, which is guarded by Turkey. So Russia's biggest routes for expansion run straight through Constantinople or Istanbul. So the two of them have always been at loggerheads. And so it seemed that's the Germans' think tank's conclusion. It's the very logical conclusion that this dente that you see between the two is not going to last.
So put that in biblical context for us, because when we look at this from a prophetic standpoint, the relationship between Turkey and Germany is really the one that we have had our eyes on for a long time. And this idea that the dente between Russia and Turkey is would change that calculus is actually, we can view that as somewhat of a distraction just by looking at it through this lens.
That's right. I just love this quote from A Key of David that trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory gave in 2012, where he said, "You watch what happens with Turkey and Germany. Turkey's going to be allied with Germany, and Germany's driving a wedge between these two great countries, Turkey and Iran," because back then everyone was talking about Turkey and Iran the way they're talking about Turkey and Russia. "But you watch what happens with Turkey and Germany." Just a very, you know, concrete forecast based on some Bible prophecy that we'll get into in just a moment. But you have that 5 years ago, and now that relationship is not fully there. There is a lot of strain in that. But then you have headlines in places like Hanselblatt that had an article titled, it was along the lines of "Turkish military power made in Germany," drawing attention to the huge role that German companies play in this Turkish military renaissance that you see going on. The way that it's German companies that are helping design Turkey's main new battle tank, that are helping to build up the Turkish Navy. And a lot of this Turkish-German cooperation goes on kind of below headline level. So you see the big headlines about the disagreements, but a lot of people miss that cooperation that's still ongoing. And that relationship is a lot better than you would believe based on the headlines. Turkey has not closed the door, flung open the gates to allow migrants coming into Europe the way they would do if there was a real serious breakdown between the two. A lot of German-Turkish military contracts, some of them have been paused, a few have been blocked, but the big important ones have been allowed to keep going. So
in spite of all of the pressures, in spite of all of the things that are causing tension in Turkish-German relations, we still see quite a lot of cooperation going on at some fairly high levels that suggest the durability of this relationship. And just looking at this from a prophetic standpoint, why would that be significant?
Because Turkey is, again, it's the pivotal power in Germany's relationship with nations in the Middle East. There are a couple of key important prophecies that talk about Turkey and the role that they play in the Middle East. So one of the ones that we reference on this program quite a lot is the Psalm 83. And you may have heard us talk about the Psalm 83 alliance. And that's this prophecy in the Book of Psalms that describes an alliance between Assyria, or Germany in modern terms, and a list of Middle Eastern countries. Now, this is an alliance that never existed in history. It's a prophesied alliance. And you can put that alongside other scriptures like Daniel 11 that kind of mention almost all the other Middle Eastern countries that are not mentioned in Psalm 83 being part of a different alliance. So you put these scriptures together and you have these two different alliances in Europe and in the Middle East, one led by Iran, the other led by Germany. But in the Psalm 83 alliance, the number one, the very first nation that it lists in that list of allies of Germany is Turkey. Mm-hmm. And you see the same thing in pretty much the entire book of Obadiah. It talks about this role that Turkey is going to play allying with Germany, and this pivotal role in terms of even being a bridge for Germany as Germany gets much more involved in the Middle East. And this is where I think things get really interesting when you start to put Bible prophecy and you use that as the anchor alongside world news events, alongside geography, seeing the role geographically that Turkey plays there, like you mentioned at the start of the program. And historically, you look at some of Kaiser Wilhelm's ambitions when he wanted to get more involved in the Middle East. Turkey was his go-to nation, and he put a huge focus on building up a relationship with Turkey as a means of reaching much more deeply into the Middle East. So what you get looking at all of this is just a really remarkable picture of the reliability of the Bible when it comes to understanding world events and understanding what you see there. And we're looking at prophecies that were written thousands of years ago, and then you see headlines like we saw in Hanselblatt, like Turkish military power made in Germany, something that just leaps off the pages of, say, Obadiah or the Book of Psalms. And so by seeing the reliability in these prophecies the way that we do, that gives us something that we can depend on for hope as you see all of the turbulent events in the Middle East. It's a way of you know, proving the Bible accurate. And then you know, the book of Obadiah that's proved so accurate about Turkey goes on to talk about saviors, the coming kingdom of God. And having proved that accurate, we can know that that part is absolutely accurate and reliable as well.
That's excellent. Interesting nexus of history and prophecy and current events and watching this unfold right before our eyes. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer. He has an article in the new print edition of The Trumpet that's up on the website right now. The article is Pivotal Power with the quip, Turkey is changing and forcing the world to change with it. Past and present trends explain why. And Bible prophecy foretells its next move. Go to thetrumpet.com and look at the new edition of The Trumpet. This is the October edition, and read Richard's article, Pivotal Power. We appreciate that, Richard. That's very interesting and something that we really need to continue to watch.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Pew Research Center published results of a poll on September 6th showing that more Americans than ever consider themselves spiritual, but not religious. There's a real shift away from organized religion and toward the more undefined and individualistic spirituality. To talk about why this is happening and what this trend means for the country, we have from our office in Britain, trumpet writer Kieran Underwood. Hello, Kieran.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's good to have you. So tell us, first of all, about these poll results.
Okay, so Pew came out and they asked people these questions, whether or not they identify as being a religious person, whether they say that they're a spiritual person, or whether they're none. And as I think a lot of people already know, in the Western world, most or more people are just saying, I'm not religious at all. I identify as part of the nones, non-religious. But in this poll, Pew also showed that there's a whole lot of people going, it was previously sitting at 17%, now it's gone to 29%, that say, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. I have a connection to some type of life force, maybe what they see as their God. You know, a God who doesn't do anything. Maybe they're just a deist. Maybe they're they believe in some type of Buddhist philosophy, some New Age spirituality. And also, what we're seeing is it's not an increase overall in spirituality. It's what has happened is that category has widened, spiritual but not religious. But overall, you have a decrease in people who are religious and people who are spiritual. So all we're seeing is a drop in how much we're seeing a drop in how many people are religious and a smaller drop in the amount of people which are spiritual. But that leads to that this big group in limbo where they say they're spiritual, but they don't have any religion.
So it looks like, just looking at the graphs that Pew Research published, that there's a somewhat level number, and this looks like 6%. From 2012 to 2017 that say that they were religious but not spiritual, and that has remained static. In other words, there's a tiny little group of people that say they're religious but not spiritual. But the growth that you mentioned, 19% to 27% over that same period who say spiritual but not religious, we're talking about four times plus the number of people who say spiritual but not religious. And all of those, say, the smorgasbord of religious-sounding ideas or spiritual ideas that you were talking about, where they say, well, I identify maybe with a little bit of this, a little bit of that, or going wholeheartedly into something that is against the organized religion that once was so common in the United States.
In the 1940s, they had this the British had this big philosophy about the life force. And it was explained rather well by George Bernard Shaw. He went around and talked about this life force. It's kind of like a guiding force of the universe. And this philosopher, C.S. Lewis, he came out and said, well, this is like a God that you can switch on and you can switch it off, and it won't bother you if you don't want it to. It gives you all the thrills of religion, but none of the costs. And he asked whether or not that type of philosophy was the greatest achievement of wishful thinking the world had ever seen. And I'm sure anyone who knows what Herbert W. Armstrong used to talk about, that really is the religion or the spirituality of this world right now.
Yeah, well, I definitely want to follow up on that. That's a very important train of thought there. And looking at this in terms of just what is it that draws people to spirituality, but away from religion. We've actually seen a similar trend in Britain. You're mentioning these British writers. Same type of thing that's happening within Britain that's happening in the United States.
Yes, the same thing. This was big news in Britain as well when it came out, and we saw it that for the first time ever, over 50% don't identify with any religion at all, not even spiritual or just no religion at all. 53% it was, and the humanist organizations came out and said, "This is fantastic. Look, Britain is turning away from religion like it never has before." And if you were to go to school, and if you were at the Church of England, if you were part of that, you would be 3% of the population. Wow. which is just crazy.
Minuscule. Yeah.
But of course, you see some of these Christians, and I saw one Christian website came out saying, this is not bad news. This is fine. They say this country is not Christian, and nor will it ever be again. Let's just get over it. They say that millions of people consider themselves to be on a spiritual journey instead. And this is actually good news, they say.
So the fact that there's more people who are considering themselves spiritual to this Christian organization you're talking about, to them, that's good enough.
Good enough, apparently, which historically seems just very – it seems crazy for a Christian organization to say something like that.
Well, let's talk about this. What is it that makes this type of thinking problematic? If you're looking at it from a biblical point of view, the individual who considers himself spiritual, the person who's, say, looking at those who are attracted to the spirituality and saying, well, this is actually a boon for Christianity, that this is taking people on some kind of spiritual journey. What's wrong with that thinking?
Well, I think we have to turn to Herbert W. Armstrong's example. He explained it really well in his autobiography, and I bear in mind here that he says this was this battle that he had when he first encountered religion seriously was one of the hardest battles that he ever had to face. And he says, "I had first doubted about religion, and then I searched for the evidence and found proof that God exists, that the Holy Bible is literal, divinely inspired," he goes on. But he comes to this point where he says the argument was over a point of obedience to God. And he said, I mean, this was the hardest thing he had to choose between. He goes on in his autobiography, he says, "The opening of my eyes to the truth brought me to a crossroads of my life. To accept it, that is Christianity, meant to throw in my lot with a class of humble and unpretentious people I had always looked upon as inferior. It meant being cut off from the high and mighty and wealthy of this world to which I aspired. It meant the final crushing of vanity. It meant a total change of life." And really, that's what Christianity is about. But he said that was the crossroads. It was a hard decision, and he had to take a beating. But the argument was over a point of obedience to God, and that was the message that he took out of it.
Yeah, that's a really excellent point. So the one who is essentially going around and sampling all kinds of different ideas and saying, well, I like this one, or this appeals to me, they're not looking at it from the standpoint of what does God expect from me. You're talking about Herbert W. Armstrong undertaking a process by which he proved the veracity of the Bible itself, that it is actually the very word of God, that God is actually expressing his will in that book, and that our job is essentially to learn what he says and then follow it. It's exactly the opposite process. Rather than looking for the thing that appeals to us, we're looking to submit ourselves to the authority that is over us.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and the Bible is just this unique book. It presents this claim which needs to be dealt with. It says, you know, I'm an authority. Prove me, if you find me historically accurate, if you see that my prophecies are coming true, then you have to do something about it. And then he also says, somewhere in Isaiah, God says, you know, prove me to see if my prophecies do come true. And if they don't, well, then you don't have to follow it. But you do have to ask that question. And if it's right, and as Herbert W. Armstrong went through and found that his prophecies were accurate and it was the word of God, then he had to do something about it. He couldn't just dismiss it, choose something else, take a little bit from here, take a little bit from there. He had to go with it once he'd proved it.
Right. It just it reminds me of the booklet that he published, Proof of the Bible. And this is actually a booklet that we have on thetrumpet.com that you can go and get a free copy of. You can get a hard copy of it or just read it online. It's actually a fairly small booklet, but when Mr. Armstrong said that he proved that the Bible is true, that it is reliable, that it is to be followed and obeyed, that is a massive point that every single individual has to come to before they would ever feel like they were obligated to do anything about it. You have to prove, is the Bible actually true? As you said, this is a fundamental point that has to form the underpinning, the foundation of any real religion in a person's life that's going to have real authority. Otherwise, you're just kind of floating around and picking and choosing. And as you even quote, you've written this article on thetrumpet.com that quoting the Apostle Paul, saying that there were going to be a lot of people in the end time who had a form of godliness but denied the power thereof. They're talking about a God that is, as C.S. Lewis said, that it was just kind of a weak God that didn't make any demands of you. And if you wanted to switch him off, then you could switch him off. Yeah, it's an excellent point that you make. So this reminds me as well of just what we've been talking about lately about religion in America, where you have these folks who are quoting the Bible, but they're quoting from it selectively. And in a sense, what you're talking about in your article is an extreme manifestation of the same kind of thinking.
Yes. Mr. Gerald Flurry, our editor-in-chief of the Trumpet website, he recently put out a Trumpet brief, which is an email sent to all the subscribers, and he talked about this high government official who was quoting 2 Chronicles 7:14, talking about what we would have to do as a nation, what America would have to do as a nation to be able to be healed from all the conflicts that are going on right now. And he says, the politician said, if we humble ourselves and pray, God will heal our land. But he omitted the most critical part of the verse. And if you read through the verse, you'll see in 2 Chronicles 7:14, it says specifically, they do have to humble themselves and pray and seek my face, but then also and turn from their wicked ways, and then I will hear them from heaven. So this is something that our editor-in-chief, Mr. Flurry, has pointed to as well. This kind of religion where you just pick and choose what parts you're going to follow, because those are the easy parts. And the hard parts, I mean, they really are hard. Those are the hard parts of it, to turn from our ways. That is going to be some of the hardest things we can do, but those are the things that God demands us to do.
Right. That's the point of obedience that you were referring to earlier. Are you going to actually turn from what is separating you from God and from the life that he wants you to be able to lead? We've been talking with trumpet writer Kieran Underwood. He's working on an article called America, Spiritual but Not Religious. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com about this trend that we're seeing within the United States and also in Britain. And watch Gerald Flurry's new television program, 2 Chronicles 7:14 Misquoted, where he describes that verse and the way that it's being misused in politics in America today. I'd also encourage you to go. You can find that Proof of the Bible from Herbert W. Armstrong under the literature tab on thetrumpet.com, and another booklet that you may want to check out. I hope I'm not overloading you here, but speaking about this point of obedience, Editor-in-Chief Joe Flurry has written a booklet called Repentance Toward God, which gives you a sense of just how important it is that we submit ourselves to God's authority and how to go about that. Well, Kieran, it's an important story. We appreciate you bringing that to our attention.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. It's time for today's last word.
If you've achieved any success in life, you've probably had help, someone to teach you, guide you, give you an opportunity, open a door in your education or your career. Now, with experience and success comes a responsibility you might not have considered, and that is to turn around and help those behind you, to give back by being a mentor. A mentor is a trusted counselor or guide, someone who teaches, helps, or advises a less experienced, often younger person. Mentoring is a partnership between one person with knowledge and another who wants to learn. It's a relationship that builds up society. General Wilbur Lyman Creech, he was commander of the U.S. Air Force Tactical Air Command about 30 years ago. He said, "The first duty of a leader is to create more leaders." There are probably many younger people in your life you could help if you'll embrace this challenge. And it is a challenge. Training young people takes time, energy, investment, but it's also an important duty and an opportunity. There is power in sharing knowledge. The Bible is loaded with admonitions about this teaching dynamic. Most of them revolve around teaching your children God's truth. It talks about teaching them diligently when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. It tells fathers, bring up your children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Titus 2 has an amazing passage with detailed instruction to older women, telling you to work not just with your own daughters, but also with younger women in general, and not really in spiritual, but in physical matters. You don't even have to have children to develop the mindset of a mentor. The way you treat young people or the way you treat those with less experience and expertise says a lot about your character. To think like a mentor, you must do two things. First, recognize someone's potential. And second, recognize your own power to help him or her achieve it. These aren't easy. They take unselfishness, maturity, big-mindedness. You have to see people the way God does and then care enough to actually help them. But once you begin building this mindset, you'll see opportunities all around you. The act of mentoring includes two components, providing guidance and providing opportunities. It's more than just giving counsel, advice, and instruction. It also means arranging opportunities, opening doors, providing challenges, giving assignments that will help your students' growth. A mentor asks himself these questions: what do I know that can benefit others? Who can benefit from this knowledge? What can I learn that will be useful knowledge to teach others? What do I wish someone had taught me? What opportunities can I provide? If you have a son or daughter, start there. Double the amount of time you spend together. Look for every opportunity to do things together. Look for appropriate challenges to give them. Think of every little thing you can do or teach them to prepare them for adulthood. How much better equipped for manhood would a boy be, for example, if his father took the time to teach him how to stay focused on a task, how to tie a tie, how to build a fire, how to treat a wound, how to change a car's oil, how to fix a leak, how to hunt, how to have meaningful conversation, how to treat a woman, how to be a man of your word, and so on. Once you make headway at home, look for other people you can help, people who work for you, your students, other young people in your community. Pay attention to them. Show interest. Develop a rapport. Think about whether you can include them in your work and in your plans. Look for opportunities to teach and pass along something of value. Young people have so many things they need to learn. In addition to benefiting your student, mentoring also benefits you. You need opportunities to think beyond yourself. Mentoring requires genuine effort. It takes sacrifice and time. Time you may not want to give. Frustration you may wish to do without. Sacrifice you'd prefer not to make. But that's thinking selfishly. We all need to learn to think unselfishly, like God. The real joy in life comes from giving, not taking. Devoting attention to helping someone else grow, to struggle through setbacks and learn from mistakes, is truly a blessed act. Your life isn't just about bettering yourself. It's about bettering yourself through bettering others. It's about growing by helping others to grow. There are young people all around you who are waiting for you, who need you, and they don't even know it. But now you do. So wake up to this critical duty, being a mentor. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests, Dennis Leap, Richard Palmer, and Kieran Underwood. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from William John Henry Butker. You cannot strengthen the weak by weakening the strong. You cannot help little men by tearing down big men. You cannot further the brotherhood of man by inciting class hatred. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.